Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for July the 31st, 2020. This is episode number 17. Today, we'll be talking about General Motors teaming up with EVgo to add over 2,700 new stations, the first Polestar 2 gets delivered in Sweden, and the Hummer EV will be revealed this fall. It's still on schedule, and we'll have crab mode. I'm Dominic Ioni, Inside EVs editor and Inside EVs forum moderator. Joining us today, we have Tom Malogny, multiple EV owner and Inside EVs editor. We also have Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, available on all your usual podcast platforms. And of course, we have Kyle Connor from the Out of Spec Motoring and One Lap YouTube channels. And he also puts together the super awesome videos for the new Inside EVs YouTube channel. Go subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. So welcome, gentlemen of the panel and ladies and gentlemen of the audience. So we've got some really big news this week. GM is teaming up with EVgo to vastly expand their fast charge network. GM has just announced it will add over 2,700 new charging points to the EVgo network over the next 5 years. So that's it's going to be like at least four stations per location. And that pencils out to about maybe 675 locations, more or less. The chargers will be put up between 100 and 350 kilowatts. So that should really help the rollout of GM's portfolio of 10 or so electric models over by 2025. So pretty exciting news, right, Tom?
Yeah, this is it's great to hear. You know, there's three real big takeaways from this that I get. Number one, for the last 5 or 6 years, GM has consistently been saying, we do not invest in infrastructure. You know, we don't invest in gas stations for gas cars. So we are not investing in infrastructure for electric vehicles. That's not our job. That's, you know, somebody else's job. We make the cars, you fuel the cars. And they have been consistent. While other brands maybe haven't invested in infrastructure, they haven't taken such a stance where they're like, we're not doing it now and we will never do it. But GM has taken that stance, and they've been criticized in the past. So, you know, that's number one, the big takeaway. Okay, they've made an about face with EV infrastructure. And number two, for me, the good thing about this relationship with EVgo is finally starting now to do multiple station sites. You know, EVgo for the longest time now has declared that they're the largest DC fast charge infrastructure company in America because they have the most locations. And that's correct. But nearly all of their locations have one charging station. And if you pull up and that's not working or somebody else is using it, which has happened to me on a couple of occasions when I had my i3 a few years ago, you know, that's it. You're sitting there waiting for, and you're waiting a while because they're all 50 kilowatt stations. So that brings me to my third point. Now, all these new stations are going to have multiple, these new locations are going to have multiple stations on the average of four, they said in the press release, per location. And they're all going to be the newer 100 to 350 kilowatt stations. So, you know, this is a huge improvement in the fact that we're going to have multiple stations at the EVgo locations, which hasn't been the case in the past. And they're all going to be this next generation, higher powered station. So that's, you know, this is great news for the industry. You know, EVgo is still saying they're the largest network. And if you want to compare it to Electrify America, for instance, Electrify America has a lot less sites. They only have about 450, 460 sites. But they already have about 2,000 DC fast chargers out there. Now, how many of them work, I can't tell you, but they have about 2,000 DC fast chargers, whereas EVgo might have about 1,300 stations in the wild right now, and they have like 1,100 locations. So, you know,
EVgo's been around.
Have the most, what's that?
EVgo's been around a little bit longer though, right?
EVgo has been around a lot longer. Electrify America has been installing stations at a rate of about 100 stations per month, which is an incredible rate. And this new announcement, EVgo and GM are going to install 2,700 stations in the next 5 years. So that's not even at the pace of 100 per month that Electrify America is at now. So, you know, while it's an amazing announcement and it's going to really mean a lot to DC fast charge in the country, it still isn't going to have the impact that Electrify America is having and will have.
Right. Well, it might also influence Electrify America to get their reliability act together a little bit too. I went to the local Electrify America station a couple weeks ago, and you know, tried to fast charge my Spark EV. Like, I didn't expect it to work, but it didn't. But that's fine because it is a 2015, and I know there's some communication protocol differences. Actually, maybe the EVgo network will be able to charge it. That would be kind of nice. But anyway, so the station has like three or four pedestals, you know, with 250 kilowatt chargers and a CHAdeMO. Of all the pedestals, there was only one plug that worked that was like online that you could use. And maybe the CHAdeMO, I don't know. I couldn't use that anyway. But yeah, so that was disappointing. So yeah, I'm hoping this will light a fire underneath Electrify America, and, you know, because they need to get their act together. It's good to have stations, but if they don't work, that doesn't really help much.
It's clearly a problem right now, Dom, the Electrify America reliability. It's you know, I had hoped that at this point they would be improving. And it seemed for a while like they were. When I did my trip down to meet Kyle down in North Carolina, Kyle and I drove, you know, two different EVs, basically from New Jersey to North Carolina. And then I drove back. We didn't have one glitch the whole way. We used Electrify America the whole way. I drove the Mini Cooper. I had to stop like every 90 miles. So, you know, I charged a lot, didn't have one glitch. So after that road trip, I kind of said, wow, I think they've done it. I think that they're getting there. But to be honest, since then, I've been doing these range tests and I'm having problems nearly every time that I'm using the stations. And I'm in communication with Electrify America about this. They promised they have software update coming at the end of the month. They have this, they have that. That's great. Do it. Get these stations working because it's a problem. The one last thing I want to add about the EVgo announcement is I'm curious to see what connectors are on these stations. You know, EVgo signed a deal with Tesla. They're the only infrastructure network now that is allowed to use Tesla connectors. So, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if these new stations pop up with CCS on one side and Tesla on the other and no CHAdeMO? You know, these are going to start to be installed in 2021. By the end of 2021, there will probably not be any CHAdeMO cars being sold in America anymore. So, right. You know, yes, there'll be legacy cars, but do you now, if you're EVgo, do you go out there and put these connectors on all the, on 3,000 charging stations for a standard that's no longer being sold? You know, right. You might see, you know, Tesla and CCS connectors. That's a question we've got to ask EVgo when we have the opportunity.
Hey, so Kyle, would having some more Tesla chargers help you at all? You're like crisscrossing the country right now.
Yeah, well, I think, sorry for the noise here. There's a garbage truck driving past. Well, I think having more options would be better. I've used my CHAdeMO adapter probably 7 times on this trip, 8 uh-huh. times, and about 3 of those I've really needed that CHAdeMO charge. And so I would say the supercharger network, no question, is by far the best network currently to drive across the U.S. in terms of getting places. I think if we can have a reliable 250, 350 kilowatt type station with Tesla connectors, I would say ditch the CHAdeMO side. It would certainly make things better. And I think we need more of a focus on national parks as such a huge gray spot that I've noticed that I see a ton of EVs at, and then I see a ton of EVs plugged into wall outlets and people camping there for 4 days to charge up their car. I just don't understand why the U.S. government wouldn't want to put fast chargers at their most popular tourist destinations.
Right.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there's a lot about the U.S. government that doesn't make sense right now. But anyway, the other one interesting thing about this is that they will have 350 kilowatt hour charging stations. So that kind of bodes well for the coming GM vehicles. We can assume that the Hummer EV and the other large, like the GM, the Chevy pickup truck, those are all 800 volt systems, and they're most likely going to use that 350 kilowatt charging. I'm not sure if they'll be like the Taycan and only charge at 275 for now, but you know, that's a pretty good speed anyway, and it'll make a big difference, especially if you have a big trucks and you're hauling stuff and use a lot of energy. You know, it'll get you down the road. So, but moving on, other great news this week, the first European Polestar 2 customer car has been delivered in Sweden. So congratulations are in order for the Polestar brand. That's the offshoot of Volvo, of course, which except for its Polestar 1, that was a high-performance plug-in hybrid coupe. This brand will build and sell all electric vehicles. So the first customer has received their Polestar 2. Stur Stensen, I think that's his name, ordered on launch day. And that was the end of February last year, 2019. And it's his first EV. And he says he has solar panels on his roof ready to help charge it. Stensen says that he's had many new cars over the year, but this quote was the greatest moment so far. So deliveries will now happen in Norway, then Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and the UK, and finally Switzerland and North America. And I believe deliveries are also underway in China, and it's built in China. So we've seen a number of reviews of this car recently. It's really the only Tesla Model 3 competitor out there at the moment, and reviewers have been pretty kind to it so far. As a reminder, this has a US MSRP of about, $59,900 before the tax credit. So Kyle, I believe you're a big fan of Volvos. What do you think of this car?
Yeah, well, I like Volvo and all of Geely Group in general. I think they're doing a really good job as their parent company. I mean, anything from the London Taxi that's now a range extended plug-in hybrid to the Lotus Evija to now the Polestar 2 launching, this company's really doing a lot for electrification and coming out with some really enticing and really cool products. You know, I think it's a fantastic story for Polestar 2 to deliver this car because, you know, obviously we always talk about cars that are promised to come into the future and that are close, but now finally there is a customer delivered vehicle on the road. So big check mark there. That shows a good future for Polestar. You know, I'm going to drive this car in just a few days. I'm flying over to New York to drive the Polestar 2 with the performance package and it's out of Manhattan, so I'm not quite sure how much driving I'll really get, but I'm going into it with relatively high expectations. You have a company that's built amazingly stylish, premium, great driving vehicles from Volvo, and now you're going to put a new 74 kilowatt hour battery pack in there, Olin suspensions, big brakes. So it's kind of this luxury, sporty mix of SUV, hatchback. It's kind of the perfect blend. And I'm excited to see if it can hold up while driving. I've sat in the car in Europe, and materials were really nice. Cabin was designed perfectly. I think their Android system was really cool that was built into the UI. And now all left to do to basically reserve final judgment is the driving impressions. And let's hope it drives as good as it looks.
It's hard to say how much of the dynamics you can really get a good feel of on the streets of Manhattan. So hopefully you have some room to groove there a little bit. I believe it's a little heavier than the Model 3, if that's right. And I'll be really curious what you think about the ride is compared to the Tesla.
Right. Well, I wish I was driving the non-performance package for, I would say, 90% of the consumers, because I don't think many people are going to get that option. I definitely would on my car. So, you know, if I were purchasing one, this is great. But I would say it's probably not necessary for most people buying an EV commuting. It's a $5,000 option. And really, it just gives you gold seatbelts, which is worth it altogether for me, but also big brakes and Olin's adjustable suspension. I believe it's manually adjustable suspension as well, which who's going to want to get up underneath their Polestar 2 and twist knobs other than this guy right here? That's why I'm so excited about it. But I am going to take it up the Hudson River. We're going to go find some good roads. Polestar has sort of this route. I grew up there, so I know some really great roads, and we're going to rip on it. Dynamically, we'll test the driver assist, and then, of course, we'll test the road comfort on the awful New York City roads.
Right on. So if you have any questions about the Polestar 2, as Kyle said, he's going to drive it in a couple of days. So leave us a comment down in the comments here on YouTube, if you're watching on YouTube or on the Inside EVs podcast post, or I guess while we're talking about it, the Inside EVs forum has a special thread in the general section with all the podcasts, you know, sitting there, and you can, you know, discuss all the things and ask us these questions. What do you want to know about the Polestar 2? So Tom, do you like gold seat belts?
Yeah, they're not really high on my list. I like the Polestar 2. I still wish they just named it Volvo. And I just think it would have a better acceptance in the US. I think the EVs are new, and the enthusiasts like Kyle and the four of us, and probably many of our viewers here, you know, it probably isn't a problem with them because they've heard Polestar, they've seen this is coming. But the average consumer, like my sister, for instance, loves Volvo. She's had like five of them, and she's been warming up to EVs now. She's asked me about, you know, electric vehicles. She's not buying a Polestar, you know, but if it was the same car and it was a Volvo, you know, S40e or whatever, she might buy it. So, you know, I just that bothers me a little bit, probably more than anybody else here, because I know, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and I don't think that seems to be a problem with anyone else. But I don't get it. I like the car. I think it's a great car. I've sat in it. I'm a little jealous of Kyle. He's getting to drive it next week. I'm only like 30 miles away. I might sneak over and like watch him and take pictures of him doing it. But
I'll come pick you up.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe something like that can be arranged. But, I do wish it was just under the Volvo brand name at a Volvo dealership with the Volvo badge sitting on it in a showroom. I think it would sell better, at least in the U.S.
Right. Hey, that's a good point, actually. Polestar has like 14 stores, like across the whole world. They call them spaces. So, yeah, they're in like China, Europe, and we have like two or three in North America, which is like, you know, nothing really. Yeah, so you make a good point. And underneath it all, it's really a Volvo, and it still has like really strong Volvo styling.
So, right, well, yeah. It's part of the Geely group, but what they're able to do with this brand that Volvo is not able to do is direct manufacturer to consumer sales. You're not going to have dealerships in the way. You know, Volvo is getting this exact car in the XC40 Recharge. Underneath, it's the same thing. Right. So it's built on the Volvo CMA platform. I agree with Tom saying that to the average consumer, they're unaware of the name Polestar. And then you hear it's going to be built in China, but it's designed in Sweden. I guess it sounds a little bit IKEA-ish. But I think really the car is going to speak for itself. I think the styling will tell people that it's Volvo. And for all the car enthusiasts that will likely be early adopters of this product, we're familiar with Polestar because they've been tuning Volvos. Polestar was like AMG to Mercedes. It was an independent tuning agency. Volvo bought the name, bought the company. It then became all the fast Volvos. Recently, I reviewed the V60 T8 Polestar, which was the plug-in hybrid performance-y Volvo. And then now it's spun off as its own company. And so, I do agree with brand recognition, but I think that'll be a 1 or 2 year problem. And in Europe, they're probably much more open to this type of thing. And in the US, it'll give it some time. But I think it's the right move, actually, just because of the sales model that they're able to have.
Mm-hmm. So real quickly, Martin, what do you think about this name Polestar? Customers will, or consumers will, you know, will accept that pretty quickly over there?
Yeah, and I don't think there's a problem with being a new brand. It is interesting. I don't know what the history is in the US. Volvo here definitely has evolved its reputation. So Volvo over here was all about boxy estate cars that would save your life in an accident, right? Ridiculously strong, the first ones to have airbags. But that was Volvo brand. Now, around 94, 96, Volvo went racing in the British Touring Car Championship. That was when touring cars over here was really, on a high. And that was when you had Formula One drivers and Nigel Mansell and driving in touring cars. And so you had Alfa Romeo involved and all the big manufacturers. And it was a time when Volvo entered racing with the estate cars, the 850 and it changed their perception over here so much. And then they started going with performance cars, and now the Volvo brand is thought of really, really well in terms of both. They've kept the safety thing, they've kept the quirky Swedish styling thing, and they've also now got this reputation of being able to make some properly rapid cars when they want to. So I'm kind of with Tom. I think if you call this the Volvo Polestar 1, the Volvo Polestar 2, the Volvo Polestar 3, you know, they can, you know, you could call it, or the P1 or the P2, whatever, but put Volvo in front of it. You've got a dealer network. You've got some pretty good brand recognition and actually some good brand values as well. Now, 20 years ago, you couldn't have done that because it was still seen as staid and slow, safe, but, you know, a bit of a boring family car if you had, you know, no ambitions. But now you genuinely choose that as a performance car. So what about in the US? What's the brand like there?
You know, that's why I brought it up. It has such a good brand recognition here. It's thought of as safe, powerful, elegant, you know, it's premium, and it's, you know, it's like, you know, the BMWs and the Mercedes and the Audis, that's like, you know, everybody has one of those, but like the Volvo almost is like a little bit of a niche. It's almost like Jaguar, like it's premium, but you're not driving the car that everyone else is driving. And it's thought of so well that that's why, to me, like, and I use my sister as the example, and, you know, she's a Volvo, loyal Volvo customer. She's thinking about electric cars now. No way she's buying anything from Polestar. Even if I tell her, well, it's made by Volvo and it's made in China, but, you know, like, it just isn't going to compute. And to, maybe Kyle's right. Maybe this is only a 2 or 3 year transition and people will learn. And maybe I'm not looking long term, and the advantages of being able to sell direct to customer will really start to flourish a few years down the road. Maybe I'm just looking at it through a fishbowl of today. But right now, you know, with this thing launching, the early adopters and enthusiasts are going to be interested in it. You know, that typical Volvo buyer, you know, is not going to be interested in this, in Polestar. And then, like I said, you combine that with that it's coming from China. There's kind of a growing anti-Chinese sentiment here in the U.S. I mean, the coronavirus didn't help. And, you know, so, you know, this new brand from China, electric, you know, I'm concerned about, I don't think it's going to sell well here at all. I really don't think we're going to sell many copies in the U.S. And I think it's a shame because it's a really nice vehicle.
What about servicing? That really concerns me as well. It's one of the, you know, I know that Tesla Rangers are a more recent phenomenon around the world, and I don't even know if they're in the UK as prolific as they are in the US. So of course, Tesla will come to you now. But what about servicing? Like, things go wrong, you know, with the best will in the world, it's a machine, and there's going to be, through no fault of their own, times when it needs to go back to a service center. So is that a Polestar space that it has to go back to? And in which case, how many miles away are they going to send a recovery truck? Can my local Volvo, are they going to be Polestar, like a Polestar tech trained in a Volvo dealership or not? I don't think so. And so that's a big concern. The car, you know, your car is the second biggest purchase you'll probably make behind your house. And it is a genuine, it's a concern for Tesla, clearly, because they're pushing their mobile service pretty hard.
What do you know about the service situation there, Kyle?
Yeah, I don't have answers, but on, I think, Tuesday. Anyway, sometime early next week, I'm going to have a meeting with the project director for Polestar 2, who's based in Sweden. And she and I will certainly talk about a lot of these questions that we bring up here, as well as our viewer asked questions down below. And then, of course, I'll even have more opportunity when I go to drive the car. But these are all valid points. Right. Cars need service networks. Things break. You know, even on my Tesla here that, you know, is supposedly, you know, will last forever. You know, I have to make service appointments quite regularly for this car and for every Tesla I've owned. It's just EVs still have problems with trim pieces and little things like this that need to go back to places like a service network.
While I've got you there, by the way, there's the big thing for me, just like a viewer question from me. It would be the software. I'm increasingly seeing the software as a differentiator in EVs, because the hardware, whilst it's not being commoditized, don't get me wrong, Tesla and you know, the individual companies are still designing their own things, but largely I'm beginning to think that software is going to be the key thing that lots of people look for. Look, it's fair to say that software in most cars until recently has been either functional or just downright sucky. It turns the heating on and off. you know, and if you're lucky, the touchscreen is moderately responsive in changing radio station or listening to a podcast. And, you know, that's all changing now, but it's not, this isn't Android Auto that it sits on. It actually, the software physically sits on the Android operating platform. So, you know, personally, my question to you would be, please give that a real hard kind of going over, and not just responsiveness times, but also, can you get stuff done quickly? Is it intuitive? Because if so, maybe more car makers are going to be looking at these kind of solutions rather than going to those typical routes they've done. Obviously, VW and have gone big on software recently and trying to sort out their things. But I'm increasingly seeing that as a big difference. That's going to be a point of value in buying an EV.
Yeah, well, I'm right. Looking forward to spending more time with the UI. I got to experience it at CES last year. I sat in a Volvo XC40 Recharge with the same Android system. And it was instant, super snappy. It was at the Google booth, so you'd expect it to be really quite good. But, you know, they are in full partnership with Google for their UI. Obviously, just seeing the XC40 Recharge at the official Google booth at CES was a huge deal. And so, look, I mean, I'm going to try a few different tasks in the system. For example, I think the easiest thing that you need your car to do that is so difficult for manufacturers to get into their system is navigation. When you get into a Tesla, this is the best part about a Tesla UI. You have a big navigate button. You touch it. You say you want to go to Panda Express, which is a place I regularly go to. It finds me the closest one. And if it's too far away, it'll tell me how far I need to drive with superchargers, how long I wait there. And it's a less than 10-second operation. This is key for every EV to have.
Right. So, yeah, I think we'll see a lot. We'll see some more like with Android Auto moving into like a car, like the Polestar. Maybe we'll see some more of that integration across different brands. So, like, for instance, our next story is Tesla is open to licensing software supplying powertrains and batteries. So maybe we could see another car license Tesla software. So you have that operating system in another non-Tesla brand, and maybe we'll see Android show up in other, I don't want to mention any names, but in other brands. So just to get on this Tesla story. So Elon Musk tweeted that Tesla is open to licensing software and supplying powertrains and batteries. We're just trying to accelerate sustainable energy, not crush competitors, he says, in quotes there. Now, this sounds great, of course, but what effect might it actually have? What automaker might be interested in these things at this point? Most of the majors already have their electric ducks lined up for the most part. VW has its MEB platform and supplying Ford with that as well. And of course, one could argue, considering the much discussed difficulties that VW is having with its software, that they could benefit here, but that would mean scrapping what they have now, which was, you know, developed specifically for their hardware and their battery systems, in which they probably have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars already invested in. Anyway, meanwhile, GM has developed its own flexible EV platform and Ultium batteries, which it will supply to Honda. I don't think Mercedes, BMW, or Volvo would bite. Chrysler has some electric tech it could borrow from Fiat. That's a scary thought. It's just given Fiat's history. But when the Peugeot-Citroën merger happens, they'll have some more as well they could possibly lean on. So I don't know if they have anything well-suited for the larger American vehicles. So like who's left? To my mind, the best-case scenario would be a deal with Toyota. They did supply some of the powertrain for the second generation RAV4 EV. That marriage didn't work out particularly well. Tesla was still pretty immature at the time, and Toyota put that into a platform just before it changed generations. So it was selling like the RAV4 EV one generation, and then it was selling the next generation RAV4 at the same time. You know, you're going to buy the new, brand new, sparkly RAV4, or you're going to buy this older RAV4 that, you know, has this third-party electric powertrain. You know, it didn't really work out so well. So for whatever reasons, they couldn't take advantage of the supercharger network. So that further limited the appeal. So what do you think about this, Tom?
So talking about, you know, Toyota introducing the RAV4 electric at the same time that they're introducing the next generation, so you can get either a new one, a new gas one, or the last generation's electric. They did that also with the first generation RAV4 EV, if you remember, when that came out, they also had a new generation RAV4. So you can get the nice new shiny one, but you've got to power it with gas, or you can get last generation one that we've been selling the last 5 years, and that one can plug in. So they did it twice. You know, once could be a coincidence, timing issue with when the car was going to be available. But, you know, you do it two times in a row and it's like, okay, you know, all right, you really are trying to push people away from the plug-in version. Wow. You know, and personally, this is like the biggest non-story of the week for us. This is just Elon bored and wanting to tweet something. Because this has been the case. All Tesla's been saying this all over, all, you know, from the beginning, that they're always open to working with partners and licensing their battery tech and everything. You know, that they're all about just helping the whole industry turn, you know, convert and let electric vehicles proliferate. So this is nothing new. You know, I don't see anybody taking them up on it. Like, nobody really has ever taken them up on it. Other than, like we said, these two cases where we had the Mercedes with the B-Class EV and Toyota with the RAV4. And in those cases, these two manufacturers just needed to get some plug-in cars out there to comply, to satisfy, you know, the zero-emission vehicle regulations. And they didn't want to put any money, much money into, you know, in-house engineering. So like, okay, we'll just buy that and Tesla, make this fit in our existing platform and make 2,000 or 3,000 of them. Or they were both very small, limited runs just to meet compliance. Right. But I don't see any major auto manufacturer at this point partnering with Tesla for like a new car that they're trying to make and sell in volume. All these companies believe that they have the best engineers in the world in their own company. They don't need to go outside and get, you know, engineers from other companies making products for them. I mean, that's at least how they believe what they believe. So, I don't see it happening. You know, I think a lot of the companies could learn a lot from what Tesla's done. It might be better to pay the $90,000 and buy the Model Y full teardown report from Sandy Monroe, as opposed to hiring Tesla to build your own platform. But, I don't see anybody taking Tesla up on this. I think this is a non-story.
Right.
It's not gonna happen because of batteries in a million years. You know, if I can paraphrase the last two or three earnings calls where Elon does have to have at least some responsibility of, you know, of what he says, not just shooting the breeze on Twitter. The questioning roughly goes, hey, Elon, why haven't you built the semi truck yet? His answer, we don't have enough batteries. And that's it. They are not open to giving batteries to anyone else until they don't need them. And that's it's not going to happen for a really, really long time. Tesla does not have a single spare battery in the company to sell to another company for that company to then mark up and sell on to their customers, let alone at any kind of scale. Like every single battery that Tesla can get, they've talked about it, you know, last week as well. So the LFP batteries, which are going to be used for standard range plus and increasingly less performance oriented cars, allow them to use the high performance cells for whatever they need, whether it's faster cars or whether that is going to be more density or whether it's going to be Cybertruck or semi, whatever. But the idea that Tesla has like a warehouse full of spare batteries that they can sell to another car maker is absolutely ridiculous. And the software thing is ridiculous as well. If somebody spent 3 seconds of thought on this, it's absolutely not going to work. Tesla spend all of their time making their cars a little bit better. And no other, that just doesn't integrate with any other car maker. I mean, what was the most, there was an update this week, wasn't it? That I'm not a Tesla owner, but isn't there something that if you're not sitting in the passenger seat, the heating and the aircon doesn't blow at the passenger. Another way of saving just another few percent of energy only keeps the driver cool. How's that going to work? You're licensing your software to somebody else and all of a sudden, oh, we have another update, by the way, but oh, your cars don't have the bum sensors in the right seat. It's ridiculous. The whole thing is just Elon looking for good PR because he's probably, as Tom says, bored on Twitter. And you know what? It never hurts to be the good guy saying, we just want to help out. We just want to help. Come on, you guys, take us up on our offer. No one's coming calling. And even if someone called, they're not in a position to say yes.
Well, for a second there, I was thinking, well, you know, if a company like just say Toyota, you know, were to say, oh, okay, we'll put up a few billion dollars to make a new gigafactory, and then we can use Tesla's and Panasonic's, you know, technology in those batteries. But yeah, does Tesla and Panasonic really have, you know, are their batteries really that much better than what maybe LG can get? Panasonic, there's a report out on Reuters, this week that Panasonic is planning on boosting the energy density of its batteries for Tesla by 20%, which sounds, you know, really good as a headline, but then you look at it, it's over 5 years, you know, and so I think they have, maybe they're sitting on like a 5% improvement right now, and we'll find out more on battery day. So let's see, how does this go? So they reported that, right, Tesla will start converting production lines at Giga Nevada in September, which will coincide roughly with battery day on the 22nd of September. Now, I might be cynical, but that doesn't sound especially amazing. It's good news about getting rid of the cobalt too. But 20% of over 5 years doesn't strike me as like earth shaking. That's like, you know, just a few percent a year. And I'm under the impression, you know, that's kind of what we've been doing all along anyway. You know, that's sort of like business as usual kind of thing. So that would make like a Model 3 or Model Y long range pack. It weighs about 480 kilograms, like or 1,058 pounds. So after 5 years, it'll be about 200 pounds lighter, maybe, because that's just the cells part. The other part, you know. So how does this improvement strike you, Kyle?
Yeah, I just think it's not a huge deal. Right now it's probably easier just to add more batteries to get a better performing electric car. Of course, we'll see cell improvements, but 20% over 5 years, we're sort of expecting that anyway, if not more. So doesn't seem like anything crazy. I will say Giga Nevada, though, certainly is going to be in for a challenge producing more cells. I was just out there maybe 3 or 4 days ago, and just the number of people during a shift change is insane. So they are staffed, they're running flat out as much as they can, and there's a lot of activity. But, you know, I think introducing these cell changes, we'll see if it makes a huge difference or not. I'm going to reserve judgment for battery day, and then reserve judgment again till it actually makes it into a car, because a lot of these stories, we hear headlines, and then in 4 or 5 years, they don't mean anything.
You're so sensible. All right. Well, speaking of Tesla, so their Gigafactory Austin site was revealed last week, but the work has started there already. Like just when they were making the announcement, there was already, you know, heavy machinery moving dirt on the lot, you know, right by the I forget the name of the river. It's located within the loop of the local river there. So there's a few videos on the site now. So if you go to Inside EVs and search for Austin, you should be able to find the most recent post, and you'll see some drone footage of the site. So that means like the race is on now for between Tesla, Rivian, and GMC for the first electric pickup to hit customers' driveways. So Rivian announced this week that their truck deliveries are going to start in June 2021 now with the R1S. That's the SUV coming 2 months later. So Rivian should have been the first, but it's pushed its delivery dates back a couple times now, understandably, of course, with the pandemic and everything. But, you know, this kind of sucks. But yeah, it is what it is. But they also included in this news, they also included, you know, this like picture of there's like a truck frame in a jig, as you can see on the screen, if you're watching this on YouTube. That's the pre-production line. They've got it completed. So at least they'll be able to, you know, get their pre-production testing fleet out, you know, a little quicker. Now they've already had some trucks out, and with the same news, they also released some video that was really super. Actually, that was the best part of this news, because, you know, I just love seeing this thing in action. So they showed it doing awesome things on the racetrack and climbing some gnarly looking hills. If it can keep on schedule, you know, Rivian should be the winner, but any more setbacks, it's going to be a tighter race, because like the GMC Hummer electric pickup truck, they just released a press release this past week and the GMC Hummer EV is going to be revealed this fall, and it will have crab mode. And yeah, so despite the pandemic, you know, it's still on target to hit its original date, which fall 2021. And so, like, along with that news from GMC, they also they included a new video with a couple of shots of the Hummer EV pickup and SUV in profile, mostly hidden in shadows. And it will have they said that we'll have this crab mode, super fast charging, which we now know, you know, could be as fast as 350 kilowatts. We'll have to see to make sure. And something with they'll have the next generation of Super Cruise and something called Ultra Vision cameras. But yeah, but I'm mostly intrigued by this crab mode. Kyle, what does that mean to you? And who do you think is going to win this race to the right driveways?
Well, I'm not so sure delivery time totally matters in the long run as to whoever's first. Sure. I think Rivian's really captured the audience of adventure EV seekers. Like me, I can't think of a better car that I would want to do this exact road trip that I'm on now than a Rivian R1T or R1S. Would I want to do this in a Hummer EV SUV? No, it really isn't for my generation. The Hummer name, they're cool. I love the H1. I don't know. We'll see what that ends up looking like and news coming forwards. Who will win the race? I think Rivian in the long run will win this race for consumer EV pickup truck. Now, the other side of it is work truck side. I don't think this is geared towards heavy duty, throwing a ladder on the back. But that's a huge market, like Tom had mentioned last episode or two episodes ago, that Rivian is not going to capture, and that leaves space for other manufacturers to come in. But I think in this particular space, which is like the guy who just drives a pickup truck around to drive a pickup truck around, Rivian's going to take it, in my opinion.
In volume, you think? Because I was seeing somewhere this week that the Cybertruck might have as many as a million pre-orders right now. Oh,
yeah, I mean, Cybertruck, for sure. When we think about that, you're going to have the thing with Cybertruck, and we spoke about this as well. It's going to take a lot of non-SUV, non-pickup truck people and bring them into the pickup truck world. It's going to take basically every Model 3 owner, and then they're going to stretch and get a Cybertruck. But are normal people off the street going to get a Cybertruck? Some, but I don't think this, even with a million pre-orders, I really do believe, and I've been going down in my estimates every week, but I think 20% will convert to orders on a good case. So we'll see.
So Tom, you're a normal person. Would you buy a Cybertruck?
Normal. Jeez. I've been called a lot of things. Rarely ever do people call me normal, Tom. Yeah, I have a reservation for the Cybertruck. I also think that the Hummer is going to be more of a Cybertruck competitor than the Rivian. Although they all compete in the same space, because it's more of like a wild, you know, rugged, you know, it's 1,000 horsepower, 11,000, over 11,000 pound feet of torque, crab mode now, you know, which while we don't know for sure what it is, I'm pretty sure it means the rear wheels are going to be able to, you know, steer also. So it would allow you to make tighter turns if you put the wheels in the opposite direction. And if you put them in the same direction, you know, the car can, while it won't be able to go exactly sideways, it'll be able to go on an angle sideways. I mean, that could be the only thing I can imagine, because like you see a crab turn its body sideways and kind of walk on an angle. I mean, that would be what makes sense. We don't know for sure, but I bet that's what it's going to be.
Individual motors that can spin opposite direction to move the car, like you're saying, but I think the front axle will play as well. I'm pretty sure it's not rear steer. I think it's just the way that they're going to be spinning each individual wheel to make it move left or right, is my guess.
So they
haven't said anything about that yet. I know that there are, the term crab mode has been used in like military vehicles. And so like I know it's out there, and in most cases when it's been referred to as crab mode and experimental vehicles, that's been because the rear wheels can angle. But, you know, Kyle's guess is as good as anyone's, and Kyle knows a lot about cars. Maybe he's right. We should learn soon what that is. But You know what's great about this, guys? And I'm sure, you know, everybody will agree. Look at what electric vehicles are doing. They're introducing all these new cool things that we haven't seen before. Like, the automobile industry was stagnant for years. And yeah, we were making cars that were faster and cars that, you know, could handle better and get better gas mileage and, you know, were quieter. And, but like, we're doing crazy stuff now with electrification. And I mean, look at the Cybertruck, look at Rivian with the tank, you know, track mode. And I mean, just so many cool things are coming out of electrification now. And that's really what excites me. Like, what's next? What's going to blow us away a year from now when somebody introduces that next ridiculous, crazy thing? And that's really what one of the cool things about what's happening with electrification now.
Yeah, well, I really hope it has rear wheel steering. I looked at the prototype. I looked at the chassis, and I didn't see anything like that. Would it indicate it could steer? But mm-hmm. I used to ride my boss back way back in the day had a Honda Prelude with four wheel steering, and man, I loved driving that thing for parallel parking or just, you know, ripping off highway exits or whatever. It was just, you know, it just felt so good. And so if you had some rear wheel steering and some front wheel steering and just see, in my mind, crab mode is like sideways maybe. And you probably couldn't do it on pavement, but I'm thinking in the dirt, you know, cause yeah, like even like the Rivian tank turn spinning in place, you can't really do that on pavement. Yeah. Even I have an old four wheel drive pickup truck, and even in four wheel drive, that thing, you can hardly drive it, you know, on pavement in four wheel drive and turn, it'll buck and jump. And it's, you know, it's really for, you know, the dirt. So yeah, I'll be really, really curious to see exactly what this thing is. And there you can see on the screen now, the clay model of the Hummer EV, that thing 0-60 in like 3 seconds. That's crazy, man. That's,
I mean, we'll see if they make it. It's not anything until it hits the production.
Sure, line. Sure. But I mean, I've seen it, and we'll be seeing. Everyone will be seeing it this fall. It, yeah, I have the same feelings about with as you, Kyle. About the, I'm not really. I was never a big Hummer fan personally myself. I liked the military vehicle. It's kind of cool, but you know, the image of the Hummer in the 2000s wasn't kind of really my thing. So I think they need to kind of reinvent the whole Hummer mystique. And, you know, it does have a lot of features that are really cool, like the glass roof and just being, you know, just being electric and that kind of performance. I mean, the original, their consumer Hummer, you know, wasn't like a super performer, but, you know, 0-60 in 3 seconds. That's kind of craziness. Anyway, Martin, you have some quick thoughts on this?
I'm not sure. I'm just not sure what the market is like for that size vehicle anymore. You know, things come around. Things are cyclical, right? So things come around, and I don't live, and I'm a few thousand miles away from you. But if it's going to be, and I've not looked at the specification, if they have put that out, but that's, it's like the Cybertruck. Like, it's such a big vehicle. Maybe you have a European head speaking now, but right. It's such a bit. The Cybertruck is so big, and Hummer is so big. And although there's no emissions on it, I just wonder how much the world has moved on from that image of, you know, the Humvee and Desert Storm. And I don't know how much we've moved on. But look, obviously, we wish everyone all the best in making these cars, because if it can be a properly impressive EV, to Tom's point, it's great. It just gives it all the combustion fans envy, and we love that.
Right. Hey, so speaking of European kind of things, then the Volkswagen ID.3 first drives have kind of happened, and we have a review up on Inside EVs, and you can also find some reviews from other outlets, like on Inside EVs. We have the big one by Autogafu, which is like one of my favorite reviewers with Tomas. So yeah, they're driving the ID.3 now. We can kind of see it and get some third-party reactions to it. And yeah, it's I don't know what to think. You can see here on your screen if you're watching on YouTube. It's, you know, it looks modern to me, but it's not, you know, super out there. I kind of like it personally. But
wait,
you know,
wait for the ID.4. Don't buy an ID.3. Get an ID.4. It's more practical. It's a crossover size. You'll thank yourself in the end.
But I mean, the inside of the ID3 they're saying is like golf size on the outside, but Passat size on the inside. Because if you look at the picture again, it's got super short overhangs on the front and the back, so that passenger compartment is like, you know, pretty relatively spacious considering what you have. Do you need an ID? Like, we're not getting the ID3 here in North America, at least as far as we know yet. It could happen, but yeah.
Those short overhangs and that flat battery. I mean, we'll say this quietly in case BMW are listening, but that's why you should build an EV on a dedicated platform. So you've got all the space inside and no transmission tunnel. It's got nothing running down the middle of it. But the car itself is fantastic. But the ID4 is coming so quickly, whether that is because you can't buy the ID3 in the US, so you can't buy one. But either way, or it's a variant of it, like the Skoda Enyaq IV, or any of those cars that are going to be the ID4 size, just going to be more practical. And it's just, although I don't own a crossover SUV, and I don't really want one, most people do.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the value proposition. I don't know if you saw the videos, but the interior had some, you know, hard plastics and some things that just for like a $35,000 pound or euro, you know, price range. Yeah, how you kind of, I thought you'd want a little bit more in the way of like soft touch materials here and there.
Well, Tom, you've seen the inside of this car, right? And I know I have. I've sat in it. And I loved it. I just thought it was the perfect blend of everything. The plastics were done in a way where it kind of felt cool and modern and funky. It wasn't didn't diminish the price point of the car at all. Everything that you touched was relatively premium. And granted, I was probably in a top spec one that you can get with everything on it at the auto show in Frankfurt. But it was I was super impressed, and I'm like, you know what, this is like the perfect runabout car. I see why they're not selling it in the US. I could see why they would maybe in like California only. I just don't think this is going to be a big seller in the US if it ever gets here. So I think smart move to keep it to other markets and let us get the ID4 like Martin was saying. But for me personally, this would be a great replacement for my electric smart car that I do all like my run around shops in, because it's the right size. It's got great range. It's got good charging. It has apparently terrible software, but hopefully that's fixed. And, I think it's cool. Tom, what do you think of the interior?
Yeah, I agree with you. It there's a lot of plastic, but it didn't feel cheap plasticky like the Chevy Bolt does to me. The Bolt, the inside, you know, and I've said this before, it just, I can't wait for the refresh next year because it just feels incredibly cheap. And understandably, GM put all their money into that huge battery. They made an affordable 250-mile EV when nobody else was a few years ago. So I understand that, but I don't get that feeling in the ID3. It actually felt like, and we have a picture up right now, if you notice, it has the same kind of a gear selector as the BMW i3 and in the same location. And that's important because I felt BMW i3 when I sat in it. Although it doesn't have as premium materials as the i3, the way it was laid out, the small instrument cluster behind the steering wheel, the gear shifter right there on the steering column, the openness, how it felt roomy on the inside, it felt like just like a different version of the i3. And that's just how I felt. And, you know, like Volkswagen has said, where the interior is like a Passat. When the i3 came out, BMW was saying the same thing. They're saying it's the size of a 1 Series, but with the interior volume of a 3 Series. So, you know, they're able to do things with those dedicated platforms, push the driver's compartment up further, push the rear seating a little bit further back. So it creates this interior volume that you don't get in cars with an exterior volume of that size. So, I feel like you, Kyle. I really like the interior. Look, I mean, you know, how premium do you want the car to be at that price point? You're not going to get, you know, Jaguar leather on a car that's, you know, starting price of 30,000 euros. You know, it isn't happening with a big battery to go far. You know, if you want to squeeze a little, you want to go Mini Cooper SE on, you know, and put a 30, 5 kilowatt hour battery or 32 kilowatt hour battery in the car, you can afford to do some premium materials on the inside. But then you've got people saying, oh, the damn thing only goes 100 miles. It's worthless. So you can't have premium materials, a huge battery, long range, and cheap price. There's got to be compromises somewhere. And yeah, they used a little extra plastic on the inside, but I think they did it well. And I'm with Kyle. It doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't feel high-end premium, but for that price point, I think it's more than what you should expect.
And worth remembering as well, in places like Germany, where the incentives are up to 9,500 euros, a 40 grand car becomes a 30 grand car. And all of a sudden, that's a big decision to go, well, hang on a minute. That's a different price point to those, if I'm going to move up towards Tesla, Polestar, right? And they're obviously different segments of car as well. You know, we shouldn't compare cars just because they have batteries, which was the old thing that people have always done. So that makes it a very, very affordable car if those countries have the good incentives.
Right on. So speaking of European small cars, the Volkswagen ID.3 we learned this week, not the ID.3, but the E-Up, which is the electric Volkswagen that they've been selling. Besides, they have the E-Golf, but they also have the E-Up. That's a very small electric Volkswagen, and that's a conversion from, they have a gas version of that as well. So that will be replaced with the ID.1 electric city car, but only in 2025, which seems like a long ways away. And while we're talking about Volkswagen, you know, that's a long ways away, so that's not really big news. But the Volkswagen has also trademarked the names E-Beetle, E-Golf Classic, E-Carmen, and E-Kubel, which is kind of neat. Yeah. I'm not sure if we really need to talk about any of that there. But speaking of cars, too.
Except sorry? The best
car like ever. Yeah?
I love the up exclamation point GTI. I think those are so cool. So I love that there's an electric version. I would drive one if it was here. They are so cool and happy.
What's his name? Bjorn, Norway Bjorn, EV Bjorn. He actually has some videos. If you look at his YouTube channel, you can go back and find he drives the E up. And so you can see, you know, it's a low cost vehicle. It's small. It's kind of, you know, minimal kind of range. But, you know, but it's a budget vehicle. So, yeah, it was selling decently for a while. But speaking of, you know, European Volkswagen things, just really quickly, I just want to mention that Poland has a company called Electromobility. I believe that's some like national companies. So I'm not exactly sure what the situation there, but they presented their all-electric E-Zero this week, which they may build on the MEB platform. We have one of our writers, Mark Kane, is from Poland, and he was a little skeptical this thing is really going to happen. You know, maybe it's I don't know, maybe they're trading in on just a more nationalistic fervor there. I don't know. And do we really need another MEB car? We've already got, you know, Volkswagen's already got the Volkswagen, Audi, Skoda. I think I'm missing one, but yeah. But, you know, it looks nice enough, and it'd be kind of interesting to see what develops there. But we haven't talked about what's charging up in our driveways this week. So we wanted to make sure we did that before we finish up. So, Kyle, I don't know, you want to give us a quick update? You're crisscrossing country. You're by the Grand Canyon right now. How's that trip going?
Right. Everything's been going great so far. We're in Page, Arizona. We've been camping most nights, but last night it got a little too rural. We were at the Grand Canyon. We went into the National Forest behind. We pitched our tent. We're like, we started hearing animals, and then we started seeing animals, and then the sun started going down, and we're like, well, maybe we should just pack up and get out of here. I mean, like, we started hearing, like, sounds all around us, so we threw all the stuff in the car, right. And then it was, like, 30 miles of back forest, rutted, you know, meaty dirt roads to take a shortcut over to Page. Otherwise, we would have had to backtrack about 4 hours around the Grand Canyon, and so we were doing a road that I wanted to do in the daylight, but honestly, it was like a rally circuit. It was great. We're dodging deer, dodging antelope. I don't even know what was coming out as mountain lions. You name it, we saw it. And then we ended up here in Page. We got in at like 1 a.m. or so. But the road trip's been great. Tons of great charging opportunities. Lots of V3 chargers. Just went through Death Valley, 123 degrees Fahrenheit. Mama 3 handled it quite well. I put the car in track mode to see the temperatures of everything because I don't have my like data logging stuff. But the rear motor was orange, which was warm, but everything else was green. And there was no degradation of performance. When you floor it at 123 degrees, it was great. Air conditioning kept up really well. We had sunshades in the back for the dogs. We went to the lowest point of elevation in all of North America, 282 feet below sea level, which was really cool, Badwater Basin. And yeah, it's been amazing. Follow the Twitter, Out of Spec Motoring, to see some cool shots of some of the scenery that we've been seeing along the way. It's really amazing. We're off to Moab today. We're going to try and do some off-roading in the Model 3, maybe get some wheels up in the air. And this trip really makes me want to have a Model Y.
Oh, you also hit the salt flats too, right? Recently?
Oh, that's right. We haven't had a chance to talk about that. We went to the Bonneville salt flats, and you know, I have been to the salt flats a few times, but I've never been there on such an empty day. And there was literally just a couple people out there. So you're able, the salt flats is just a dry lake deposit of salt that you can drive on. It's open land owned by Bureau of Land Management. And so you can drive your vehicle on it as fast as you want, which we did. And so we were able to get the car up to 158 miles per hour. It took four runs for me to get there. The first three were, I had to slow down for some traffic way out in the distance. But driving on salt is real sketchy. It's not like doing 158 on pavement, which you can do any day, all day, super easy, no problem. This, the car is moving around. It's like driving on ice. It's super slippery. It's very sketchy. Braking is really odd. And it was just a really cool experience, bucket list item. But 158 miles an hour, the car, limited power at 30% state of charge. Everything was in the red. We got the drivetrain nice and warm. It was 100 and something degrees outside, and it didn't break, so that was good. And there's a supercharger right on the other side of the flats.
Oh, nice. Yeah, people don't realize, like, speed and that kind of a surface, that's like a non-grip surface. So, you know, bad things can happen really easily. So unless you really have experience in room and in a vehicle, you don't want to drive like over 80 miles an hour on a dirt road or on salt.
Yeah, it's very similar to dirt, I'd say. Basically, between 100 and 140 was really sketchy. And then after 140, it kind of settled down. You know, I took the dogs out, left them in the hotel room. We took the roof box off, of course. And you can see here in the photos, if you're watching on YouTube, we just destroyed this car with salt. I'm honestly surprised it's held together and not rusted through at this point. But Tesla won't care when I trade it into them, I'm sure.
So, hey, Tom, so this week, you've had some experience with the BMW i3 with the Rex this time. You're like our BMW i3 expert at this point.
Well, I have owned two of them. Right. I don't own an i3 anymore. But yeah, if you recall, a couple of weeks ago, I talked about this on the podcast. I did the 70-mile Inside EV 70-mile-an-hour highway range test with a new BMW i3 BEV, all electric. And we did 141 miles driving at a constant 70 miles an hour. So I wanted to do one with the range extender. And luckily, a friend of mine just took possession of a 2020 i3S Rex. So I asked him, could we go out on the turnpike and do the 70 mile an hour range test? And he obliged. And we did it a couple of days ago, finished up with 126 miles. Which is exactly the EPA rated range for the i3 with range extender. So a little surprising. The odd thing about what BMW has done now with the i3 is for the initial i3s, the BEV version was rated at 81 miles of range. The range extender was rated at 72 miles of range. Then when they increased the battery size to the 33 kilowatt hour, the difference in range was 114 for the BEV and 97 for the Rex. Still kind of close. But now with the 2019 and 2020, and it has the 42 kilowatt hour battery, the BEV is rated at 153 and the Rex is rated at 126. Kind of doesn't make sense, because with the Rex, you just lose 6.5% of the battery Well, you don't lose it, but the range extender turns on when the battery drops below 6.5%. And then you also have this extra weight penalty of like 350 pounds or so. So it shouldn't be like I'm surprised that the EPA range rating is so great on this latest. The difference in it is such a difference in the BEV and REX versions because it wasn't on the first two iterations. And our range test kind of proved that that's wrong because we achieved the EPA range rating on the REX, and on the BEV, as you would expect, we got 15 miles less. So right. I don't know what BMW did with the EPA range rating, but it's definitely odd. In any event, yeah, we did that now. We've done 10 cars. Kyle does some of the 70-mile-an-hour range tests. I do some of them. Sometimes we do the same car. But we're compiling a list on Inside EVs now where we do these 70-mile-an-hour highway range tests on the same courses so we can kind of compare vehicles side by side. I'm trying to get an e-Niro now, but unfortunately, Kia doesn't have any of them in the test fleets, like the test drive fleets, I guess because it's not a new car anymore. They've kind of pulled them out, so I can't secure one. If anyone lives in the New Jersey area and has an e-Niro and wouldn't mind loaning me their car for the day, maybe I can loan you my Model 3 for a little bit. We can make a swap and give me some seat time in your car to do the range test. I'd appreciate it.
Wow. We do have the, I don't know if, whether you sent it for broadcast, but I did have your graph that you've done. Do you want me to put that up or is that still top secret?
Oh, no, the range graph, you can put that up. Sure. That shows the, those are the vehicles that we've done so far. As you can see, the Model 3 long range has had the best range at a constant 70 miles an hour so far. We did 290 miles. That was with my personal car. Model Y's next. Then you've got the Kona did 238, the Bolt at 226, the Leaf did, and that was the Leaf Plus 190. Then we have the Hyundai Ioniq at 171. Then you see the BMW i3S BEV at 141, the Rex we just did at 126, the Mini Cooper SC at 108, and the Kyle's famous smart car did a whopping 51 miles at 70 miles an hour.
That's my favorite out of there. The smart car.
It's a great car.
You know what? You're so much happier during those 51 miles than you are in the 290 of your Model 3.
Be just looking at it on the chart. So there you go. Job done.
So, hey Tom, are we going to have this on a page so people can access this page on a regular?
Yeah. Okay. So right now, I've been putting it on all on the posts of all of the range tests we do at the bottom. Right. But it's going to have its own dedicated post and eventually page.
Awesome.
We just wanted to get a bunch of vehicles on there first before we gave it its own page, you know. And we now that we've got 10, it's starting to get to the point where, hey, yeah, this is something to look at.
Right on.
And once I get back from this trip, I have a whole bunch of Teslas lined up just to fill in the list of all of them. So from Model X's pre-Raven, post-Raven, same with S, all of the Model 3 variants. Actually, while I'm in New York for Polestar, that night I'm taking my mother's standard range plus and doing a range test in that. So we'll have just a full Tesla list in just a few weeks.
Awesome. Excellent. I was going to get a Kyle. I don't know if you were if you have the ability, but I can rent one. I wanted to do the Model 3 long range rear wheel drive. I can get a hold of one of them and do it. Do you have that?
Yeah, we have one in the family, so I can do that. No problem.
Because I think that should be the best. That should have the longest range, right?
Yeah, either that or the new Raven Model S. We'll see.
I mean of the Model 3s. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, of the Model 3s. The long-range rear-wheel drive is just the best configuration of any Model 3, period, I think.
My friends have that one.
Yeah. If you don't need to, you know, the all-wheel drive for, you know, if you live in some of the northern states, people feel more comfortable with all-wheel drive. Like, we do a lot of driving up in Vermont, and that's why I wanted to get the all-wheel drive.
And that's only like 5.6 seconds to 60?
No, it's way less than that. The rear-wheel drive, it's been software updated over time. I had one. I loved it. That's what we set the Cannonball record in. It's just the best long-distance EV you can possibly get. I think we'll test the Model S Raven now that it has 250 kilowatt charging, although I hear it only just hits it for a half a second and then falls off.
Right on. Hey, so, okay, that brings us, this brings us to the end of our show. But if you have any questions about the Polestar 2, like we said earlier, Kyle's going to be driving that in a few days. So leave them down in comments. Or if you'd like, go over to the Inside EVs forum and we have a Polestar section there. We have just like a few of the review videos. But we'd love to, if you're a customer or if you're interested in that car, we'd love to have you, you know, tell us what your plans are, if you plan on getting it, what your expectations are. Right. So thank you all for joining us. If you have any comments about any of the topics on today's show, you can comment on the Inside EVs podcast post or the YouTube comment section below or on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread. And don't forget, you can find and follow all of our panelists on Twitter. Tom at Tomalog. Martin is at EV News Daily. Kyle is at Out of Spec. And I'm Dominic _ Y. Click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications below. And we'll see you all next week. Ciao.